Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Culture File Weekly, which we'll spend in the company of comedian Rob Newman. As part of the comedy duo Newman and Badil, Rob Newman had everything a 1990s stand-up could want, in particular, fame as the first stadium comedy act, and the one for which the phrase comedy is the new rock and roll was first coined. But these days his obsession is with stand-up's potential as an act of critical communication. Of course, when you say it like that, it hardly sounds funny at all, but Newman has managed to make rollicking comedy from everything from environmental catastrophe to fuel politics, genetics, and in his very latest show, neuroscience. I went for a cup of coffee with the funniest environmentalist on the planet outside a cafe near his home in Holloway, North London. So for this special edition of the Culture File Weekly, why don't you join us for a flat white? Anything to eat with that? Do you have a loyalty card?
We are sitting pretty in Holloway in North London, England, and it's mild and blustery. And we're outside a little community-owned cafe run by some nice Brazilians, and yeah.
This is almost local, am I right? How ingrained are you in it? I mean, in your daily life, are there a lot of organisations around here that touch you and your family?
Yeah, the school's here. My dad used to work in a factory on the Holloway Road. I guess so, yeah.
There was a time where you were very involved in various groups and a great advocate for getting off your arse and joining things.
You do what you can, and everyone's person's got sort of a limited amount of energy. And also, I've stopped being asked to do benefits now, so I have to sort of hint. I had to hint the other day and say I did one for a benefit for one for CND and one for Destitute Asylum Seekers of Huddersfield. But I had to sort of hint, say, I would do a benefit if someone asked, you know.
Now, when I first started getting involved with radical, direct action, non-hierarchical, eco-autonomous grassroots organisations, I didn't understand the concept of no leaders. I thought I did, but I didn't. And I got up to the nearest alpha male or alpha female and say, here's what you should be doing, why don't you do this? It'd be great if you lot ordered this. When are you going to do this? And they give me this look that I never understood, which was kind of, I think, weird. I went up to the next alpha. When are you going to do this? It'd be great if you did this. Why haven't you done this yet? Yeah, when are you going to do it? It'd be wonderful. Why don't you do this? And again, they give me this look, like. And after about a year, the penny dropped, and I finally realised what that look meant, because they won't tell you, because that would be hierarchical, right? But I finally realised that what the look meant was, yes, good idea, why don't you do it yourself? You print the leaflets, I'll distribute them. You call a meeting, I'll attend. You organise an action, we'll come along. And from the moment I realised that, my whole philosophical outlook changed. And from then on, instead of suggesting things that other people could do, I stopped suggesting things altogether in case I'd be expected to do them.
As you say, it often is a kind of split for people when they think about what they can do through their own work and whether that should be channeled into kind of direct, specific actions. And I suppose in your own work, it isn't as though the concerns that you used to give vent to through those groups have disappeared in any way.
No, it's still there. It still informs everything I do. I mean, it gives you a way of looking at things, both in the book Entirely Accurate Encyclopedia of Evolution and in the new show I'm doing now, The Brain Show. And The Brain Show is much less overtly political, but some of the scepticism about some of the claims that are being made by neuroscience comes from having heard these arguments before in other contexts in the past. The subject matter of each show dictates the vibe of it, how you do it. In the Entirely Accurate Encyclopedia of Evolution, which came out of the stand-up show New Theory of Evolution, I had a very definite sort of thesis that I wanted to put about evolution, which is to say, here's the works of Darwin, a very wonderful and little-read philosopher and scientist, whose views are totally opposed to the people who call themselves Darwinists in our time. And there's an interesting split here. And actually, I think a lot of damage is being done to us by the people who are shamelessly traducing Darwin's name. And that had a certain tone. With The Brain Show, it's a much lighter tone because I don't have one definite thing to say. I'm still staggered by the extraordinary pessimism about human nature of some of the leading neuroscientists. It's just breathtaking. But one can have great fun by opposing how most people feel about the world to these extraordinary curmudgeons who say things based on almost no evidence that, you know, the smile evolved as an aborted snarl, or different nationalities have different brains that see things in different ways. I make merry with neurobabble, and it's a much lighter tone, and somehow the jokes themselves, because I think because brain imaging is such a visual thing, I end up doing quite a lot of visual jokes in the brain show, and there's about £15,000 worth of props, including a brain imaging hat and a flashing squid and a skull xylophone, and that gave sort of a levity to the tone. New Orleans Olympic bid committee, Miss Afghanistan, like Chow. So maybe if we look at Dawkins, the selfish gene, and you really, it's something you take apart in the book.
I didn't sort of invent it, it comes from Bill Hamilton's selfish herd theory. It certainly doesn't come from Darwinism, this idea. I mean, Darwin says those communities which included the greatest number of the most sympathetic members would flourish best and produce the most offspring, and that's his definition of natural selection. Dawkins' idea derives not from Origin of Species, but original sin. It's very close to Martin Luther's definition. It's the infection from our mother's wombs, and this inborn sickness and hereditary sin condemneth to eternal wrath and damnation every creature born into the world. And you find it's based on philosophical assumptions rather than the science. It's the same in The Brain Show now with Ramachandran. He says that the smile evolved as a snarl. Well, that doesn't come from Darwin, because Darwin says that our habit of uttering reiterated sounds from a sense of pleasure evolves into the tendency to contract the orbicular and zygomatic muscles when any cause excites in us a feeling which, if stronger, would have led to laughter. So he says it's halfway to a laugh, not halfway from a smile. And so it doesn't come from Dawkins, but it's part of a sturdy philosophical tradition, and it has its root, if you go to Baudelaire. And that's ironic, because they're saying, oh, look, I'm just a man of science. There's no misty, vague sentimentality about me. I see reality as it is. You may not like it. But actually it derives from Baudelaire, misty, vague sentimentalist, late romantic poet, who says that laughter is a man's way of baring his fangs. And there's a certain type of quite adolescent mind to whom this, you know, focusing on the dark stuff is somehow scientific and rigorous and deep, whereas a more cheerful idea, such as Darwin's, is somehow not scientific. And it's a great slander on human beings, and it's sort of scientism rather than science. And original sin was never a very helpful myth, and if it comes back as a myth in a lab coat, it's still not helpful.
Why do these particular myths seem to underpin our world when, you know, we can look at them with a rigorous science or maybe newer science and see that they don't quite make sense? But they do sort of fit in with the politics of our world.
Yes. Firstly, newer science such as epigenetics, the idea that the complex cellular machinery of proteins actually controls the gene, and that the organism controls the gene and the environment controls the gene, and that actually genes are not all-powerful, and they don't have psychologies, and they don't have purposes. And that's a fairly robust finding of the science. And the other thing is, of course, the spectacular collapse of the Human Genome Project, which at the beginning of the 21st century was confidently predicted it was going to discover hundreds of thousands of human genes, each one coding for detailed behaviour. You know, and this, a gene for getting into debt, a low voter turnout gene, and a homelessness gene. And of course, we now know there's only 25,000 human genes, and not a single gene, not one, codes for behaviour one-to-one in a simplistic, reductive manner that was widely believed in by all right-thinking people as recently as a decade ago. And so that's collapsed, and so it has opened an interesting area for people to change their ideas if they're not married to the church scientific's sort of theology of and this doctrine about of DNA. But, of course, it fits into the idea of there is no such thing as society. It fits into this idea that you get from Thomas Hobbes, that we're involved in a war of all against all. So that's there in Steven Pinker's, I think, scandalous claims that early humans were in a state of perpetual war, and he bases this on this ethnographic analogy with modern hunter-gatherer tribes using what I think I show in the book are wildly inverted statistics. I mean, he cites as an example of the savagery of the indigenous Quiba Indians on the Colombian-Venezuelan border, he actually doesn't know it himself because he's not using primary sources, but at third hand he uses men, women and children, 16 of whom were gunned down by white ranchers in this famous massacre, La Rubiera. But, you know, he's a major thinker, so he doesn't need to look at sources or have any academic rigour of any kind. That burden falls to stand-up comedians.
The science you portray in the book works a little bit like art did in a former way, in that it offers us kind of visions of structures of society, kind of fictions at the moment, but just alternative ways of thinking about the reality around us.
Every political system tries to justify the inequalities by saying it's just a law of nature. And so if you say, well, actually, there are very few laws of nature. I mean, that's one of the things that other sciences don't like about biology, is that it doesn't seem to have laws, but there's a lot of... It's not denying competition, but just saying that there are both things, both are totally intrinsic to life, and yet somehow it's seen as more hard-headed and rigorous to focus on things being, in Tennyson's phrase, red in tooth and claw. But that's not true of very much of the phylogenetic tree. And I got this actually from David Attenborough, was that baboons is sort of, you know, it's a matriarchal group, baboons. New males can only join the troop if they know a female member, and even then they have to prove their worth by serving a probationary period during which they prove their worth by babysitting. Now, that may sound like it comes from a feminist pamphlet written in minstrel ink, but it's actually from David Attenborough's Life on Earth. And Ernst Mayr was one of the leading members of the evolutionary synthesis, and he says group selection means that the social cooperation among the members of the group means that the fitness of the group is greater than the arithmetic mean of each individual member's fitness. So all boats rise together, or as Benjamin Franklin said, we will either be hanged together or we shall assuredly all hang separately. It's Dictyostelium discoideum. They're forest floor foragers. They live in colonies of between 10 to 100,000, and they subsist on a diet of the rotting bark and decaying leaves that they find on the forest floor. These individual forest floor foragers, however, in time of crisis, they send out a chemical signal, and they all congregate in a central location, and they spend an afternoon turning themselves into a single multicellular slug with light-sensitive eye spots and a tail. And as this slug, they writhe, squirm and wriggle their way towards a patch of sunlight, and when they get there, the first 20% form out of their bodies a ridgy stalk up which the other 80% climb, and when they get to the top, they form a giant fruiting berry, and just as the breeze disperses dandelion puffball spores, so a gust of wind bursts the fruiting berry, and the dicty discos go floating through the air, and amazingly, this evolutionary strategy works. But the 20% who form the rigid stalk, they do not get to fly off to pastures new. They die that others may live. And that's quite common in nature. And it's an example of group selection, which one of the founders of the modern evolutionary synthesis, which in the 30s and 40s sort of rescued Darwinism by showing that rather than being disproved by Mendelian genetics, Mendelian genetics powerfully corroborated Darwin's theory of natural selection. Now, group selection is frowned on now because we all know individual laissez-faire capitalism is the only game in town. We all know that private good, public bad. So it doesn't matter what Ernst Mayr says, it doesn't matter what Darwin says, it doesn't matter what the Dictyostelium discoideum are doing. And so it's a common thing in nature that we survive as a group. People say, well, the lion has evolved to this, or the zebra has evolved to this, but it's penguins, plural, that have evolved to withstand six-week-long Antarctic blizzards by huddling together. The penguin hasn't evolved to do anything except menace the good people of Gotham City. And after the Second World War, this idea of survival of the fittest was an odium, because dead heroes leave no offspring, and all the best and the brightest had died. And so it was just scandalous to say. But then, you know, a decade or so later, we can sort of say clearly, you know, cream rises to the top and all that stuff.
The G8 has today endorsed an American plan to bring democracy to the Middle East.
The level of naivety necessary before you can talk about an American plan to bring democracy to the Middle East. You will not find that level of naivety anywhere outside of 1970s porno films. Gee, mister, you mean the time machine only works if I take off all my clothes?
The G8 has today endorsed an American plan to bring democracy to the Middle East.
And which country were they discussing that particular morning? Why, Iran, of course, which until 1953 was a secular democracy.
What becomes obvious in your book is that ideas like the selfish gene are a reflection of a kind of a political world that is being held in place, in that if everything is about dominance and destruction of the weak, then that makes an absolute case for our economic system and a case against any other economic system, because that would be just unnatural.
You can see why certain ideas get wafted through, because they're sweet music to the rich and powerful. And that was true when Herbert Spencer, the man who invented the phrase survival of the fittest, he was toasted at this banquet at Delmonico's restaurant in New York by Carnegie, you know, because he'd seemed to give laissez-faire capitalism a make it look like a sort of cosmic force of nature. But I also think there's a certain sentimentality that likes this idea of this tough kill or be killed, this dog-eat-dog world. It appeals to a certain macho prevalence. So it's not always like explicitly ideological. It's things that sort of feel right to a certain macho cast of mind, I think. Like Top Gear, you know.
That said, however, be advised, I shall shortly be using the phrase puppet regime. I don't want to get overexcited or to overreact in any way. You are a sophisticated audience. You will credit me that that is the given socio-political terminology, the only accurate phraseology wherewith to describe how Kermit Roosevelt installs Shah Reza Pahlavi's absolute dictator of Iran, head of the notorious Savak secret police, which in 1976, he's still there, Amnesty described as responsible for the worst human rights atrocities on planet Earth. This was Britain and America bringing democracy to the Middle East in 1953 style. Yes, but that was then. This is now. Now there's an American plan, endorsed by the G8, I might add, to bring democracy to the Middle East generally, not just in Iran, but in Iraq.
Some of the most telling examples you have in the book are about cooperation. It's something that, you know, it informs your political life, but it also informs the way you think about science.
Well, yeah, because science is based on a huge web of cooperation as well. It isn't sort of individuals going for long walks. And even when you do get an extraordinarily freakish genius like Newton, I mean, he himself is the one to say, if I've seen further than others, it's because I stand on the shoulders of giants, you know. So science in and of itself is quite a good example of things being done in a cooperative way. Also, how could language evolve among small isolated bands of people who are just snarling at each other, you know?
You found evidence of that in a poem by W.H. Auden.
Oh, yes, it's a beautiful poem by Auden. And he says, as a rule, it was the fittest who perished, the misfits forced by failure to migrate to unsettled niches, who altered their structure and prospered. And that's a very good half-truth. And by the way, when people say, oh, well, you know, we're survival machines, well, given that 98% of all species that ever exist are now extinct, we're not very good at it. We're not very good at surviving on Earth.
To understand the reasons for the invasion, you've got to go back to a 1971 OPEC meeting at which the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries did decree that from this day forth, wheresoever a barrel of oil is bought or sold anywhere in the world, it may only be bought or sold in US dollars. Mexico, selling oil to China, US dollars. Holland, trading oil futures into Morocco, US dollars. Even though the more natural currency for that particular transaction would, of course, be hashish.
One of the main crossovers in both shows on evolution and the ones on the brain is to defend ourselves against this staggering pessimism about what it means to be human.
It's very interesting that you say defend yourself, because this book here is in the genre of popular science, and it really takes issue with other people whose science comes through the same genre of popular science, people like Dawkins and Pinker and so forth, that don't get challenged, that their academic position is allowed to be their standard of knowledge, but they still work in popular science.
Yes, there's an idea that if you are to challenge these people, you must have lost your mind. And that was one reason for writing the book, because if you challenge it, people cite false consciousness. They say, well, he wouldn't have said that. You must have misread that. So here it is. Here's the quote. Here's the, you know, chapter and verse. Here's the edition. Here's the... And so this is what he says. Now, here's what the science says. And to be able to fully reference all the sort of scientific papers and everything.
It's a densely researched book. I mean, as a stand-up set, the thing that you're largely missing is the footnotes, because there are plenty of footnotes.
Yes, yes, that is. And I used to sort of... Burdenham. And the original idea for this book was to do a verbatim transcript of the stand-up show, because I really like Stuart Lee's book that did that, and the Bill Hicks Love All the People book. And the first idea was, oh, where are the sidebars and the footnotes in Stuart Lee's book here about his mental processes while during the performance and during the writing? I thought this could be about the science, but then I wrote the radio series, and I had much more to say than there was in the stand-up, and to be able to actually quote the papers and to be able to take on some of these ideas, you know, head on.
When you're writing a book, you've written some novels, do sets find themselves in there, or does material find it? Is that some way of also keeping it?
Novels are very different, whereas this I like the fact that this is my first non-fiction, The Encyclopedia of Evolution, and I felt like I knew what I was doing because it's sort of a combination of stand-up, which I've done a lot of, and journalism, which I've done a fair bit of. And one of the exciting things about writing a novel is it's very exploratory rather than expository, but often I think, and now I'm lost, and now I wish I knew exactly what to do here. I felt they were getting better, the novels, but I really felt like I knew what I was doing with this one, which I didn't always feel like.
You mentioned the history of oil, and you say a decade ago, it seems hard to believe, but something like that, it's still full of an analysis that is not exactly common currency.
Yeah, and by such analyses, I've parlayed my way into near obscurity.
That show opens with you saying we'd want to look at the history of the Iraq War when Britain invaded Iraq in, I'm going to get the year wrong, 1913?
Yes, I like those sort of secret histories of those things. And I suppose part of my interest in biology is natural history, that actually you can use some of the skills of a historian to sort of say, well, you're saying that this is a universal, but you're saying, oh, girls are hardwired like the colour pink and boys are hardwired like the colour blue, but not until Louisa May Alcott's 1869 novel Little Women do you find a character saying, I'm going to try out the new French fashion of putting pink ribbons on the girl babies and blue ribbons on the boys. And that's the first time that appears in literature. I took a break from stand-up to be a primary carer of my daughter for couple of years, and I didn't know how I was going to come back, because I thought, I genuinely don't know what people are talking about, because I don't own a television. I watch snap shows and I think I don't know what they're on about. But then I just thought, well, but if you just talk about your own thing, I mean, I'd be torn apart if I went on those Bullingdon Club type panel shows in which millionaires mock the poor and afflicted. I wouldn't do well on those because I don't really know what they're on about. So
I get the impression you've speeded up now. This is two shows you've done in quick succession. Are we on a new roll?
Yes, I have speeded up. Number one, I'm really enjoying it. My manager, Eddie, said, well, look, don't leave it too long next time, because we built something up, then I have an idea for an historical novel, and then I disappear for 6 years, or I take a sabbatical to bring up the kids. But now, and I thought, oh, God, I've got no ideas, and then I suddenly just found a book on a friend's shelf, one thing that led to another, which led to the Brain Show, and then And someone said, oh, it's like you're back in the game again. And I feel like I'm back in the game again. And I'm enjoying doing it. And so I will not be accompanying the family to Bulgaria, but we'll be in Edinburgh at the festival. I sort of like those bands like the Blue Nile that put out one beautiful album every 10 years. And it's soaked in experience.
The Clash is the other reference point, isn't it?
Yes, I love The Clash. I met them quite a lot by just bumping into them in the street when I was a teenager. I used to just wander around, come down from my village on a train and walk around, and you'd see them around, And they were always very kind to me. I loved their music, and it was passionate and it was beautiful. It introduced me to lots of different things, and I think, they really helped. They got terribly slagged off by the Germans, but they really helped steer. I mean, at the beginning of the punk rock, it could have gone into, there were all those idiots wearing swastikas and they really steered it into being a sort of anti-racist thing. Well, a lot of my political education came from them, but I always think, if only they just had a holiday, do you know what I mean? They were just, you look at their schedule and you think, goodness me. Just, and they really loved each other. And Penny Smith, who took pictures of them, so they were very unusual for a band, because they were just physically, a group of men, they would touch each other and they were always leaning on each other. They were very, and it's more like a group of girls to be like that. And she said it's very unusual as a photographer to see. So they really loved each other, like the Beatles loved each other. And as with the Beatles, you think, oh, just take a day, just take a year off, just go off, just, you've done enough now. But they're in like a cortina a lot of the time as well when they're being slagged off for being millionaires. And then they finally get this tour bus, but then, yes, Jones was difficult, and yes, Topper had his heroin habit and da-da-da, but that could have just,
I wish they'd carried on, but you know, I don't. Then maybe it's perfect that it ended when it did. And
well, that's the thing. There isn't a lot of Clash material, and now you've got a couple of perfect shows, you know.
Okay. Yes, exactly. And I'm going to definitely try and record the Brain Show.
I suppose the other thing that television has, and we haven't talked about it at all, but your physical comedy is something that people don't pay as much attention to. But when I'm reading the book, I'm thinking, I can almost imagine the gestures that go with it. What's so amazing about the history of oil is a lot of the physical work that happens there that you're not getting in podcast or radio.
Yes. Well, I do rehearse a lot on performing it, and I like watching performers who are physically funny as well. I mean, it's stand up to a physically funny and funny boned, like Daniel Kitson, like Ardlo Hanlon. I think he's just funny boned. I think Bridget Christie is like that. They do enjoy the physical side. Some people who want to, they think, why are you on telly? Because you haven't got any ideas for visual jokes. And I'm a student of the visual gag, and so I would like to sort of put more of those in. And it gives you a whole other palette to work with as well. I was cycling along round here. I saw Julian Barrett walk, and he's taken a sabbatical. And I was just cycling, and I had my daughter on the front, and I stopped, and I was berating like some old codger, and I said, you've got to go do some more comedy. I said, I was watching Eric Morecambe the other day, and he said, the important thing is to have funny legs. And I thought, you've got funny legs, so you've got to get out there. And he was writing a play. I said, don't write a play. My legs aren't as funny as his. And so I said...
You've got funny wrists, though.
Yes, I've got funny, yes. Funny wrists and ladylike ankles, which I'm always twisting as I carry all my props on the train. But yes, and I like those florid gestures. Well, yes, that's a thing I shall put into subsequent treatments. To say, you know, this will be a chance for viewers to see his funny wrists and florid gestures, you know. I've got a sort of whole new costume now I wear on stage as well, which I really like having. And someone once said that you should be able to sort of imagine a little doll of all the great comics. And you said Steve Martin, you've got a white suit, and Jerry Sadowitz, you'd have the bowler hat and the thing. And, you know, you could imagine this and a Miranda Hart falling over one. And I think I'm wearing a bow tie and these Dickensian trousers and a waistcoat now. And I just really like that. It sort of, Oh, man, yeah. Now you made me feel dissatisfied about being on the radio.
I wonder why so many stand-ups feel that stand-up isn't sufficient, that they must write novels or plays, or, you know?
I think people should be allowed to do other things and to be sort of creative in different directions, and sometimes you get told off for doing other things as well, whereas one is an art form, which is the stand-up, and I think it's just maybe because it's just downgraded as an art form, and eventually you think the only way anyone's going to review me... And
winter is setting in here.
Winter is setting in, and the crash barriers are being blown over. I don't know why they would do that, but I remember thinking, oh, no one's ever going to respect the stand-up. I'm going to write a book, then they'll respect me. But now I think because there's people who are doing really intelligent stuff in stand-up, you know, Dave Gorman and Josie Long, and that's getting people to... I'm thinking, well, actually, now there is sort of a bit more respect for stand-ups, and... And also, there's nothing like that buzz you get from the audience as well. So it gives you more colours on the palette, though, if you can do sketches as well. Do you know what I mean? And that's one thing we've said. Or if you've got props and things. And I suppose it's wanting to have something that lasts, because you do a gig and you feel fantastic for 2 hours, and then afterwards it's gone and it's like it never happened. You go to, everyone says, oh, John Gielgud, what a marvellous actor. You see this picture of this young person, you know, in some of the theatres, in a black and white picture in 1940s in tights, and you think, well, that looks like it must have been an absolutely terrible production, but we have to believe that it was great. And so I think wanting to leave something so that your name is not writ in water.
But presumably now also something your daughter could look at.
Yeah, she does like the sort of physical things, and... I've got these two bobtail squid that light up and flash, and this brain hat that flashes, and she likes those props and things. And she says, oh, you should wear your glasses on stage. You look more like a comedian. And so there's one reason I'm wearing these sort of Mr. Funny trousers and this bow tie now, because she wanted me to look more like a comedian.
Hey, I'm just going to get some.
comedian Rob Newman there, ready for a 2016 full of epigenetics, neuroscience and comedy trousers. In 2016, Rob will be touring The Brain Show, no Irish dates of yet, but with the Culturefile bump now in full effect, you never know. I'll be back with more Culturefile at 6:30 next Saturday evening. Till then, bye now.